Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Syrett, S Y R E T. Jim Perry's interest in the esoteric and paranormal was first inspired by staticky AM radio broadcasts of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell and reruns of In Search of. Vice calls Jim's podcast Ufomet one of the best podcasts to get into UFOs, as Jim believes everyone has a weird story and is devoted to uncovering the intimate, human-centric version of these supernatural tales, no matter what type of phenomenon. You're about to hear, among other things, his dinner with a real vampire when Coast to Coast AM continues. Jim Perry is a podcast host, creative producer, and entrepreneur based in the Pacific Northwest. His fascination of the anomalous events that happen in people's lives inspired the creation of Ufomet, the critically acclaimed audio documentary podcast about the strange and our relationship to it. Jim Perry, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Oh, I am terrific tonight. Talking to you, Richard, it's good to talk to you again. And for the first time on Coast to Coast AM, this is literally a moment that I've built in my head for the last 20 years. So, no pressure tonight, right?
Well, we're delighted to have you. For those not familiar with Ufomet, first of all, the name is rather intriguing. What does that mean, Ufomet?
Yeah, so Ufomet is just a little bit of a play on words. It first started as trying to find something that could be sort of brandable, ownable, something different and unique from what is out there in terms of the paranormal or the supernatural. So I came up with Ufomet at first because I thought it kind of sounded cool. It sounded like UFO, Ufonaut. So harken back to some of my favorite writers in the field. And what I discovered shortly after, you know, folks had asked me about this, I asked myself, does that really mean something to me? And what I think I really broke it down as is really a play on words, a euphemism for a playful devil, a euphemistic Baphomet. And that really relates to maybe Pan, right? This trickster element that seems ever-present in the phenomenon in whatever way that it presents itself. And so I'll stick with that in terms of what that means now, I think. It only came to me after the fact, but isn't that the way this all works sometimes?
Sometimes, indeed. So I described it earlier as, what if NPR were to tackle the paranormal, This American Life, and so forth. So for people not familiar with Ufomet, the podcast, give us a sense of how it's put together and how you approach these topics and how it's produced.
Yeah, so Ufomet, I mean, I love that comparison because I think it's really apt, and that was a huge inspiration for me. You know, I took a look around the landscape of what kind of content was out there for the supernatural and for these stories that are out there for people that are experiencing these things and living with them day to day. And I realized there wasn't really many of these stories being told in that documentary format in an audio way. So we took influence from public radio and shows like This American Life and adapted that to a process which sees me, you know, really being boots on the ground and going and embedding myself and spending time with experiencers and folks that are, you know, up to their necks in this phenomenon. And that process really evolved into this documentary work. And, you know, I kind of figured there certainly were enough really great interviewers and talk radio shows out there. So why not just try something a little different? And what a great excuse for me to go and travel and embed myself in these places and meet some of the most unique, fascinating individuals on the planet.
And, you know, you have a kind of an origin story where I guess this really kicked off for you, and it was something you say changed your life. It was a trip to a UFO ranch. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so, you know, going back in about 2014 or so, you know, Richard, I found myself a well-adjusted and pretty successful art director at a global advertising agency. You know, I had moved to Seattle from a small town to chase dreams with my wife and happily married, but, you know, there was something about the day-to-day in the position I found myself in. I felt empty. I was a workaholic, and I've always been a kind person, but it worried me that I was thinking too much about myself and my career and what my intent was being potentially wasted on. What was I serving? You know, was I serving a real purpose? And, you know, from that, I developed a pretty substantial anxiety disorder from this that led me to searching for anything that could comfort and remind me who I really was. And one of those things I used was actually this program, Coast to Coast AM. I would listen and remember that sleepless 9 or 10 year old me staying up all night with Art Bell. And seemingly, these stories of varied phenomenon, all leaving more mystery, you know, than answers, actually kind of left me feeling like myself, as if the phenomenon itself, the mystery, that force, sort of welcomed me back. So shortly after that, I, you know, got the bug. I developed Euphemet as a local talk radio paranormal show in Seattle, and was sort of finding my way in the field, you know, kind of discovering what my place at the table could be. Could I become a researcher? Am I, you know, simply a content creator, or am I just me somewhere in all this? And I think what I found is I'm a storyteller, you know. It's taking those elements that I had developed through my career and then applying them to this space. And so in 2016, I'd started doing the show, and I felt like I finally, at that point, received some answers, or at least maybe an impression that was enough to communicate a message about what all this means to me. And that was only after I went to East Eddy Ranch. So myself and a small group of family and friends, including my brother Kyle and his wife and my uncle Lonnie and our friends, you know, all people outside of the paranormal content bubble, mind you, we took a retreat to East Eddy Ranch. Now, it's in eastern Washington state. It's currently owned by this sort of UFO mystic named James Gilliland, who has appeared on Coast to Coast many, many times throughout the year. So the listeners are probably very familiar with him as well as the ranch. And this land of his sits at the foot of Mount Adams and within what reportedly Native Americans call sacred ground, and what many believe to be within sort of a very large triangle along alleged ley lines and vortices of the Northwest here. Of course, those, you know, being the same locations of the Kenneth Arnold UFO sighting and, you know, Maury Island and all of these sort of ridden with lore events of the paranormal, including, you know, the myriad of Sasquatch, right? So, you know, the thing about this place, you know, even thinking about it, even collecting my thoughts on it, it sits so heavily in my psyche because going there was a really unexpected discovery point for me. And I think created a lot of empathy for me. And so what happens is you go there and you hear all these stories about what people witness and things like the mountain lighting up at night. Brilliant bursts of tiny lights appear as if pinholes all over the mountain. Then, if that's not enough, UFOs start to pass by. Because East Eddy, like Mount Shasta, Superstition Mountain, perhaps even Skinwalker Basin, is a mountain that is situated on these ley lines that allegedly create some sort of vortex there. And at that point, I had listened to James Gilliland and witnesses saying that after that, it only gets more strange from there. So this trip was loaded. We were loaded up on it, right? So myself and the group tried to get there to really keep our expectations in check while arriving. by this time,
is that even possible?
You know,
to keep
right.
your expectations
so by this
in
time
check?
In my personal journey, I had befriended a group of mystics through, you know, the content I was creating, like my friend Tim Rothschild, who kind of presented me a good lens, Richard, to sort of constructively experience this stuff through, which is a sort of a non-dual shamanic lens. And keeping my intent in check with this visit and sort of trying to feel through the rest, the emotions, whatever phenomenon we may or may not encounter, I felt skeptical, but I felt ready and happy and grateful to be there. But as soon as you drive in, you know, you immediately encounter folk art all over the place, adorning trees with alien faces and spacecrafts, and you are welcomed into the space that immediately lets you know it embraces the strange. So it's a little hard to keep your expectations in check in that sort of location, because they're almost willing you to participate in that way. So,
and how about your traveling companions? What did they have an equal? Did they have the same level of expectation? Were they skeptical?
You know, in equal parts, right? I mean, I think there was a general excitement. You know, I think the idea, the allure at that time, the entertainment value, should I say, of going to a quote-unquote UFO ranch, I think it's very easy to get wrapped up in that, even those that are uninitiated, right? And, you know, my brother and my uncle, they listen to Coast, right? And they would help me on my show sometimes. And, you know, so they were initiated, but at the same time, we were all sort of skeptical because we weren't participants at this point in time. We were on the outside looking in. We were voyeurs in that sense. But what was going to happen that night essentially, you know, took us to the carpet and made us sort of make a choice. So, you know, that very night that we got there, we go into this location called the Field of Dreams, this big open space that overlooks Mount Adams. And sure enough, the lights do show up on the mountain and in the night sky. And the other campers that were there were, you know, we were all sharing night vision goggles and, you know, sort of chatting amongst ourselves about these streaking, you know, pulsing, burning little orbs. And we're interrupted by James Gilliland, who comes out into the field, and he casually announces that he believes a mothership will be flying over the homestead shortly. And not long after he uttered those words, Richard, does a brilliant, distant object float above us all and zoom straight towards the mountain, as if on cue, as if summoned. And I got to say, as an optimistic skeptic, I felt rattled at that moment, right? What had become like sort of a source of comfort and solace with you know, being entertained by the paranormal, now felt like something else, as if a new stage of my relationship with the anomalous was sort of rushing towards me, set to kind of confront my nature. And I, you know, at that moment, I kind of felt alone, like I was maybe going nuts. And I'd never forget that feeling I had going to sleep in my tent that night. It's that same feeling I later learn so many others feel out there. You know, I think it's very easy for us to talk around this phenomenon and in a very abstract and scientific way, relating the truisms that could be possible with this stuff. But at the end of the day, it's a human relationship that's displayed with these experiences that we can't explain. And there's a human cost for that. And it was only at that moment in time where I was confronted with, hey, man, like, no, this is some real stuff. It's not all just fun and games, and there's things at stake, and there's people's relationship to not only the unknown, but about themselves. So, in fact,
were there other experiences at the Isetti Ranch, Jim, while you were there?
There was. You know, we did have a slight encounter with finding some Sasquatch tracks, perhaps. You know, we had been hearing from other campers that they'd been seeing these two Sasquatch, and, you know, James Gilliland, some of the ranch staff would, you know, mention this as well. And you know, there was two younger girls that drove into the camp, and they leaned out their window to me and my crew, and they mentioned, you know, kind of shouting out at us like an alert, like, "Hey, we saw a Sasquatch out by the side of the road right there. Did you guys see anything?" We're like, "Absolutely, we did not, but we don't. I mean, that's crazy. You're strangers. You just drove into this place, and here we are, and we're talking about Sasquatch immediately." So, around the same area where they reported this Sasquatch to perhaps go through, we went and investigated this area, this clump of trees, like sort of in the distance field. And sure enough, there was this large track in the loose sediment up to this grove of trees that sort of whatever it was, perhaps disappeared into nothing. So, I have photos of these things, but, you know, from the night before, seeing all the light activity and seeing the mountain light up in this anomalous way and then encountering tracks, you start to wonder, Richard, you go, well, if this stuff is happening, then what else can be true, right? So, you know, after kind of being broken up, our last night there brought an opportunity to connect in a deeper way. So I decided, you know what, like, it's getting very bohemian very quickly. Let's see if we can connect to this place. We all separated, and I decided to reapproach meditation. Now, this is me coming in to this field days before, you know, entertained by this, but a skeptic. And now I'm meditating to the mountain face because I feel like there's something trying to connect with me here. So I don't know at this point if I've kind of lost it or not, or if I'm just on this sort of journey out of nowhere. So it's dusk, and I'm sitting there and I'm meditating and I'm, you know, maintaining a soft focus with this mountain. And I'm breathing in and I'm breathing out. And I start to notice, Richard, that a light is forming on the mountain. And, you know, I keep going about my business and I keep breathing in and breathing out. And I start to notice that as I breathe out, the ember grows in intensity. And as I breathe in, the ember begins to disappear. It dissolves as if an ember. And I sit there for the next 20 to 30 minutes, breathing in and out of the mountain, of this light, in some sort of constant communication. This thing is tagged in or tapped into what my breathing is. And, you know, I cracked at that point. You know, mystics would maybe call it a shattering. You know, Robert Anton Wilson would call it, you know, entering Chapel Perilous, right? You face this crossroad, and you come out the other side, stone paranoid or an agnostic, is what I think Robert Anton Wilson says about it. You know, at that point in time, I didn't know what was true, and I changed my entire life after that. I quit my full-time, really well-paying agency job. I even quit Euphemet when I came back home because the burden of that experience painted my perspective on the paranormal too much. So at that point, I decided I'm going to give myself some space and kind of heal from that, get my legs. And then, you know, shortly after that, I was presented an opportunity to restart the show. And that's how Euphemet came in this documentary format, is because it gave me an opportunity to go find others that had experienced things they could never quantify, they couldn't explain. And that's where the intimate nature of the show came from as well. Like, I want to get in touch with the emotional side of what makes this tick, what our relationship to the unknown really can be. And
right. It seems to be, having heard the podcast, less about the actual phenomena and more about how it affects human beings, fellow human beings, like you were affected, he said. We'll take a time out, Jim, come back and discuss further on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, and the website is strangeplanet.ca. NASA Brain Power may soon start making a big difference in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. A prototype ventilator built in just 37 days by engineers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, passed a key test this week at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City, agency officials announced yesterday. "We specialize in spacecraft, not medical device manufacturing," JPL Director Michael Watkins said in a statement. "But excellent engineering, rigorous testing, and rapid prototyping are some of our specialties," he added. "When people at JPL realized they might have what it takes to support the medical community and the broader community, they felt it was their duty to share their ingenuity, expertise, and drive." And you can read more about this wonderful story in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. Back to more of my conversation with podcast producer Jim Perry when Coast to Coast AM continues. And we are back with Jim Perry, the host producer of the paranormal podcast Euphemet. Jim, before we proceed, how do people subscribe and listen?
Oh, thanks for asking that, Richard. The easiest way is to go to euphemet.com. There will be a lot of easy links for how to subscribe, rate, review, follow on Spotify, etc. And in fact, on our feed tonight, I have posted a new episode that says Coast to Coast listeners start here. And it's just a great episode to get you into the series, to see what the vibe and the feel is. And that's the best way, euphemet.com. That's euphomet.com.
And the little thumbnail is a moth. Explain.
Yeah, you know, the moth was really interesting to me as its relationship to life and death, for one. You know, it's a mythical... It's a mythical sign of approaching death, of a reverence for life as a reincarnation. And on face value, I just like the notion that moths are typically flying towards the light, right? They're flying out of the shadows to something illuminated. And I hope that's what I'm doing with the show and with these stories.
You mentioned at the East City Ranch you saw some Sasquatch tracks, or what appeared to be Sasquatch tracks. There is another incident in which you may have, and we stress may have, communicated with a Sasquatch via what you describe as a secret code. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, absolutely. This was a very interesting assignment for Euphemet. I'll go ahead and explain the subject and how I even came to the story. One day, a middle-aged man named Brian Bland, who I believe maybe you've spoken to before, is walking his dog.
Yes, I have, yes.
I thought so, yeah. So he's walking his dog in the foothills of the rugged mountains of British Columbia. When he gets an almost psychic sense that someone or something is reaching out, and it's calling him to the mountain forest. So, almost in a way where, you know, it's kind of welcoming him to go and find a discovery. So, what happens is he breaks away and goes out, and he's met with these unbelievable sort of stick and branch structures everywhere, and these trees weaved into domes, and wonders as he continues to see these same shapes. As he continues to go out there, these patterns, if there is something bigger to all of this. So it compelled him to do some researching and asking advice from folks like his First Nation friends. And he discovers there is a belief that these repeating symbols that he's been seeing are created by Sasquatch. And these glyphs, as they're called, are essentially used to communicate with humans and identify individual Sasquatch families moving through these remote mountains. So I heard about that, and I made my way to British Columbia. I was with a producer, Chelsea Weber-Smith, from American Hysteria, and we drove deep into the woods with Brian. Now, I'll say, you know, on assignment with this stuff, when you're driving deep out into the wilderness with absolute strangers with unbelievable stories, you're hoping that something like paranormal happens in that case, and you're not not getting into something like more reality-based, like a, you know, am I going to be left out here? Will we be murdered? You never really know. But Brian was a class act. He was a great guy. We were set out to meet this new family of his, this Sasquatch family. He describes, after an initial awakening of sorts by communicating and communing with this Sasquatch family, he finds a group of folks online who actually meet in message boards to get together and decode what these sigils could mean. He was then introduced to a Sasquatch in person shortly after. He says that physical creatures started to appear to him, and many times actually sort of come to him in a translucent state and almost fading between here and somewhere else. And he goes on to detail, as the relationship evolves and more trust is earned with the Sasquatch family, he details actually playing games with Sasquatch children, you know, throwing rocks together with an adolescent Sasquatch, and believes, as well as this group, that the message they're trying to impart about them is resoundingly the existence, their existence itself. As the Sasquatch family believes that a knowing about their existence from certain individuals will actually help raise the level of consciousness of humans. So we went out there. He took us to some of the sites. He showed us some of the stick formations, and there were repeating...
If you could, let me just jump in here, Jim. If you could describe these glyphs or sigils, as some have described
really
them.
What's really interesting about them, Richard, and you know, like, that I'm very truthful in my interpretations of these things, because I like to keep a little bit of a skeptical side, one foot in and one foot out in all of this. Some of these glyphs and sigils are as simple as preceding patterns or number shapes found on the ground, as if branches had maybe fell from the sky and landed in specific arrangements. Could a hiker stumble through, create some letter A's with some sticks and branches? Perhaps. These are the sort of things that were most typical. Where they get interesting for Brian and this community are finding ones that are more ornate. So you'll have essentially these shapes that are built out of rocks and formation that are repeated along trails over a matter of weeks or months or even years, some report. And essentially they found this notion that these relate to individual Sasquatches. They gave names even to these individual Sasquatches based off these glyphs they found. Some of the other things that Brian has found were similar to what we've seen other Sasquatch researchers, investigators, you know, point to definitive proof of something with incredible strength and size, you know, bending and shaping large trees into, you know, pretty incredible creative formations. He's come across that in his time as well.
Like shelters? Is that what they were building? Nests or shelters?
Yeah, he's come across things that looked like they could be domes, you know? So the notion that there could be a community, a family of Sasquatch, building temporary shelters and leaving them there as some trace of their existence is something they really believe. What did I experience personally with my producer? You know, I didn't see anything of that nature, but I saw photographs and I read through the posts on the board, and they have a really great like Facebook group that I'm still a part of. At the end of the day, what really connected me with Brian, though, was one instance that seemed to really transcend whatever sort of anecdotal investigative mode here. After Brian's mother passed, he took time away from the mountains. He was close with his mom. It was very tragic. He was pulled back down into real life, essentially, grieving and healing. When at one of his lowest points, he goes outside of his, you know, sort of suburban home, approaches his car to find one of these noteworthy glyphs that, you know, Dave targeted as the name of one of the leaders of the Sasquatch family sitting right in front of his car. He's a pretty private man. He believes that it wasn't, you know, someone playing a trick or trying to get one over on him. He believes that that member of the Sasquatch family connected and resonated with him in a way where they wanted to show him that they cared about him and they wanted to give him a caring message. And so for me, whatever that means, whatever the sort of 3D reality tunnel legitimacy of something like this actually happening, it doesn't really matter to me. I think what's true undoubtedly about this story is that there's a emotional connection between this notion of his relationship with the Sasquatch family and how much there's care there. And I think that a lot of people can find a, I don't know, a warm embrace by the anomalous in that way. You know, maybe when there's not other family even around, there's something about the other side that can take us in and welcome us.
It's been about a year and a half, maybe closer to 2 years, since I spoke with Brian Bland. Have you been in contact with him more recently? Are there any updates to this story?
You know, I have, and you'll probably be excited to know that their community has just grown exponentially. And there's actually something similar to, like, sort of branches or offshoot Facebook groups and message boards that have sprung up from people all over the world, Richard, that are now getting together to go out into their local wilderness and see if they can, you know, use these tips and tricks and techniques that others have already to make some connection with Sasquatch families in their area. What's interesting about it is they've started to discover reoccurring glyphs across the world that seem to symbolize maybe not just one specific Sasquatch family, but a number of Sasquatch families. Or the other thing they consider is that, well, are these individual Sasquatches? If this glyph actually symbolizes this individual, are they transient in a way that we could never imagine before? So one of the things that's interesting about this group, as it scales, as it grows larger, the ideas and the concepts are still wild and free and open to interpretation about what all this could mean. What is our relationship to these things, and what are they trying to tell us? And I think that's a really refreshing perspective in 2020, right? You know, approaching the supernatural and these anomalies from a place of curiosity and wonder. So the other thing about Brian is I feel really bad because of this pandemic. They had an event in September that I was planning to go and planning to record more and see Brian again. It was this great big gathering out in the woods in British Columbia that I was excited to go and see Brian again. What a wonderful guy. Really loves music and is a great singer. Like, I don't know if you knew that about him, but the whole trip into the forest, we were serenaded by him. So he's a soulful man.
Right. I didn't know that about him. But now that you mention it, you know, with the sheltering in place and so forth, you're not able to get out on the road. What is the status of Euphemet? Are you in hiatus, or are you producing more studio-type pieces?
Yeah, I've been producing more studio-type pieces. I've been bringing some friends on, doing some interviews, doing a little bit of an ode to late-night talk radio, a little tip of the cap. You know, I've been very, very busy with that. Thankfully, I have a few episodes in the can, and so I have still been editing and continuing my third season, and, you know, more episodes, more documentary episodes will release, but I tell you, I don't have very many of them, and this is the most I've been home in years, Richard. I mean, doing Euphemet, I am constantly on the road doing this. And there's a part of that that I really miss. I really miss getting out in it, I think there's this thing that anyone who is obsessed with this, there's a level of synchronicity that occurs, a level of wonder, a level of seemingly the phenomenon itself saying, hey, come and play, when you're out in the midst of it. That when you're just in front of your computer, it's a little hard to manifest sometimes. And so I'm missing that. I want to go see sort of my old friend, the phenomenon, at this point, if that makes any sense.
Yes, yes. I did some traveling when I had my old TV show.
Yeah.
And the road does, it, at times it can be somewhat tedious, you know, endless strings of cheap hotels and a shared stale sandwich and so forth. But then when you get back, after a couple of weeks, you find yourself itching to get out there again. So you must, besides the, you know, the unknown and playing with the paranormal and so forth, you must just miss being on the road, I'm guessing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I know you're a music guy, and produce some great content about that as well. You know, so many musicians will call it something like the bittersweet curse, right? When you're out there, you think, well, okay, well, it'd kind of be nice to be home. But then when you're home, you're like, man, I want to get back out there. And, you know, if anything, traveling, exploring, adventuring has always been a true love of mine and something that I didn't really get a chance to do very much as a young kid. So now, you know, sort of being in my 30s and taking this on as sort of, you know, really my full-time job and my life's work at this point, having an excuse to get out there and just get lost, I feel like the luckiest guy in the world. You know, I'm so grateful for that opportunity. And when you add in, you know, the notion that I'm just not out there endlessly spinning my wheels or, you know, sort of listening to Queens of the Stone Age driving through the desert to nowhere, I'm out there, you know, breaking bread with some folks that have had some of the most profound supernatural experiences that anyone could ever dream upon, and going to some of the most, you know, vaulted, haunted places in the world. You know, I think we'll probably talk about the Stanley Hotel maybe in the next hour, you know, the Queen Mary.
Oh, yes,
in
you
Walker
will.
Ranch, you know.
Yes, you'll take us. Yes, you'll take us there. When we come back, you'll take us to the Stanley Hotel, the inspiration for Stephen King's The Shining. You'll tell us about your dinner with a real vampire, Jim Perry of the Euphemet podcast, stays with us.